Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
2020 has been the year of things happening that are completely out of your control. There's one thing you can control, and that's shaving. Our sponsors are Manscaped, are here to remind you to do so. Manscaped is here to provide you with the best tools for your grooming experience. Chaz, have you had any funny manscaping experiences?
Okay, so here you go, Derek Riley. I used to only ever say, shave your face, right? Don't shave anything but your face, because it is totally brilliant to shave your face before you razor shave with Manscaped. But I've realized women don't like chest hair either. And so I've gone south. I have gone to the chest, and it's totally easy. And I mean, do you shave your chest?
I think men who shave the chest are a half man, Chaz.
I don't shave all of it. I just shave the top part that comes up to my neck. So it's like an extension of my face down, right? I leave the chest, I suppose. I misspoke. But I shave the top third, the neck portion of my chest.
That's ghastly. Yeah, and you get that thing where you get that little regrowth. And you see the regrowth on men, and you go, God, you actually shave the hair on your chest and your neck. I mean, neck.
But I ain't going razor down there, so I'm just cutting the weird fluff that grows up over my V-neck. That's it.
Oh, yeah, that's fair enough. But you can probably just trim that with scissors. It's probably a more effective experience.
Are you kidding me? The Manscaped tool makes it like I don't even have to think about it. I just do it in seconds, and I'm gold.
Well, in fact, listeners to the show will get 20% off and free shipping with the code DIRTYWATER at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And you use the code DIRTYWATER. Please use DIRTYWATER, because this whole thing will be pointless unless you use DIRTYWATER. So if you're going to do it, use DIRTYWATER, please. It's time to grab 2020 by the horns and shave. Take your grooming game to the next level.
The wait is finally over. Football is back. You might not be at the game this year, but can still be in on the action of Bet Online. Chaz, have you been betting?
I haven't been betting yet, but that's only because it's so frustrating to bet here, where I am so happy for easy online betting, because I've always got an instinct that's always wrong.
What would you be laying your money on?
Oh, right now, I'd go hard on Joe Biden, to be honest. Do they bet politics or no?
I don't know. I think so, yeah. You can bet Biden. I think he's a... probably 1.5-1 semi-favorite.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't bet him, but
I'd bet on Joe Biden fucking dying in the Oval Office.
I'd bet. I mean, yeah, Trump feels to me like he's cooked. This is not going to be a good ad talking about how Trump is cooked.
But how good is Kamala Harris? She's beautiful.
I mean, except now she's offline. She's been derailed by the COVID.
Oh, I thought an assistant got COVID, huh?
Yeah, but they're really taking her offline purposefully to show how much more responsible they are.
How much she cares.
Yep.
And how much better she looks in Timberland boots than Melania Trump, huh?
I mean, my goodness.
Okay, so from game spreads and totals to team player and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. And there is always the online casino as well. It never closes. You can just spend all your money, lose everything you got, lose your wife's money, lose everyone's money. Okay, so head to betonline.ag to get today. AG, I guess, is Antigua. Isn't that amazing?
Sweet. That's where I want to be betting.
Not sure. I want to go to Antigua. So head to BetOnline Antigua today. BetOnline.ag today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Again, that's BetOnline.ag for Antigua and sign up today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. I'm Derek Riley and welcome to Dirty Water, where stentorian force and a bullying wall-slamming style of address is preferred over careful and intelligent colloquy. Today's guest is a former world champion surfer famous now for his oratorical gymkhanas on WSL broadcasts and for his annual week-long junior events, less so for his former careers as a butterfly collector and anarchist. Although warmed slightly by age, for he's the sort of man who sleeps little, receives visitors at his sunset beach house in carpet slippers, and is happy to dine simply on goat's cheese, he will occasionally open up a front if he feels his electrons shuddering. Today's guest, Mr. Barton Lynch.
Hey, Derek. How are you, mate?
Why? So you're in Hawaii by the looks of it.
Yeah. We got here in October last year.
Yeah. Oh, fuck.
And we were leaving. We went to Japan at the end of January, just for 2 weeks to renew our visa after 3 months. And then we came back on the 30th of January and we were meant to leave end of March and the flight got cancelled and the visa we had went till April. So we booked one at the end of April. That got cancelled. Then we were in a situation where we were applying month by month for stays of departure and we got May, June, July, August, September. And then they said, you're done, mate. You're up. You've got to go. And in that means we had to be out by September 25th. But in the meantime, I applied for an O-1 visa and have been going through that process for the last 5 to 6 months. And that came through just when they booted us out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it was kind of good because we had to leave and go to an embassy somewhere.
Yeah.
But not many countries will let Americans in, or not many countries are open, and then not many countries will let you in if you've been to America, and then not many countries will America let you back in from. There was Ecuador, Egypt, Cuba were our three options and we were going to Ecuador and I was talking to Ecuador and then the Mexico City thing just popped up out of the blue that you could go there. So we left here not even with an appointment, just knowing that we'd been approved for the visa, but we had to get seen and get the visa put in the passport and then get back here before winter started. You know what I mean? It was kind of the objective and so yeah, the mission was successful and we got the visas and it was a 2.5 week trip all up, which wasn't too bad, I suppose, could have been anything. And it was kind of interesting to venture out into the COVID world and anyway.
So do you still have your house at sunset?
Yeah, that's where I am now. I'm just sitting on the side here. Family are inside. We're in quarantine, mate. I'm in quarantine.
For how long? 2 weeks?
Well, 14 days of freaking hell. So the whole things have been there's some very judgmental people out there. And I've been spending my life keeping my opinions to myself since I was a young man because I know that what I believe is very unpopular generally. And the appetite of people to actually understand and comprehend something outside of what they think is not very large. You know, they're very freaking judge. And I've never seen such a self-righteous, judgmental humanity as the one we're living with now.
So how did you deal with it internally and intellectually?
You know, and I suppose it's a very fine line, the conversation, you know, because people aren't very accepting of other people's opinions at this point in time. And when you're scared and threatened, you are the least tolerant of stuff outside of your safety zone, you know, and like they say, there's no no growth. You know, anyway, it's a thing. And for me, what I've valued my whole life is freedom. That's why I do what I do, is to wake up and have the right to choose. The right to choose where I go, what I eat, you know, like that's. And at the same time, I've recognized in my life that there's not a lot of tolerance or open-mindedness, generally speaking, to thoughts outside of what they believe, you know, because they believe it. That's their truth, and I respect everyone's truth, you know. And I have my own truth, but I actually understand that people are not very accepting of my truth. My truth's a little bit, I don't know, it's a little harsh for the fairy tales that people are sort of grown up accepting. Anyway, let's not get too deep, shall we?
But where does that come from? Because, you know, I know when you were younger, you were a teenage anarchist and a butterfly collector. So, you know, were your mum and dad, were they intellectuals? Your dad was a cop, wasn't he?
My dad was a policeman, and my mum was the, you know, house mum, and my dad worked a few jobs. He also mowed lawns and was involved with Wild Beach Surf Club. Was club captain, and so he and the boys would hang down there, and life was pretty simple back then, honestly, you know. And I those Whale Beach days were the days of innocence in a lot of ways, you know, because, you know, you felt safe. We lived at Whale Beach, between Whale Beach and Palm Beach, and you could run around on the streets and ride your bikes and just be rat bag kids and go climbing down the, we used to climb, go down the rock shelf below at the terrace there. We lived right above the terrace. Yeah. And we used to climb down there and climb through the caves and hang on the rocks and find fossils. And, you know, you were outdoors a lot. And then, so that was good living back then, you know, Northern Beaches, 60s. You know, 60s and the 70s, early 70s. And then when my dad passed away, that was kind of like a trip into the innocence was over. When we got to Mossman and Mum moved us away from Wild Beach, obviously when you leave something without confronting it, it's kind of, you got to be around stuff to confront it, you know. And it's like, you know, I say, it's like going to Byron Bay. If you know what I mean. It was, you know, we kind of left and then I was, you know, went to school, didn't know anyone. And from that day, from that moving there, that was when my learning started.
How old were you, 9 or 10?
11.
11, right.
11 went back, yeah, 74. Yeah, and so away we, you know, that's when I started learning, and that's when I, you know, when I look back at that period of my life, there's parts that I'm not very proud of, in the ways and means I went about maintaining my independence and not burdening my mother with my existence so she could put her energy into my two brothers, you know.
Yeah.
That was kind of, I remember the morning I was lying in bed and I remember hearing my mum cry out in the living room, and it was, they were tears that, or the crying was, it wasn't a joke. You know what I mean? There wasn't, and you knew things weren't going to be the same again when you were lying in bed. And I just went, oh, I don't know if I can get up and face that right now. And just kind of rolled over for another bit of shut eye to try. Maybe we'll wake up and be different in half hour. You know what I mean? And so that when I went outside and they said, you're the man of the house now, you know.
Jesus.
And that was, I didn't know what to make of that. So I just thought that my immediate thing was, I've got to be independent. My mum can't have to worry about her life. And I need to look after myself. We get on with some stuff. You know what I mean? And that was kind of how I responded to that situation. Back then, there's no counseling. There's no seeing people about anything. The police never came over and sent. So you imagine what happens now, you know what I mean, in the world that we live in now, and the therapies and the, you know, the whole thing that would go on. Now, back then, nothing happened. No one came. You're just on your own, mate. Deal with it. You know, I don't get on with life. And so my godfather said to me that morning, he said, what do you want to do? Is there anything I can do for you? So I want to go for a surf. And he took me down to Kitty's, and I paddled out, And I wrote a few and I cried and I wrote a few and I cried and I wrote a few and I cried. And that was, it was there for me. And it's always been there for me, you know, in that sense. And that's kind of, that's, it's been my haven my whole life. That's where I go. That's where, you know. So to be here, and it's right there. It's just right there, mate. And
you're in backyards, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, it's a, you know, you've just got to, in the stark contrast of life, it's a good place to be quarantined if you had to do it.
I mean, look at you now, and you're surrounded by palm trees and beautiful patch of grass and this beautiful weatherboard house and a backyard sunset that, you know, some people are stuck in two-star hotels.
Mate, that's what I keep telling my son. All of ours are first-class problems, boy.
How old is that?
I don't like the bagels, first-class problem, mate.
Yeah.
And Mexico City was a fantastic experience in that for him to see people, kids, just sitting on the side of the road begging. And he's complaining about getting up and walking 100 metres to eat some wonderful meal at a restaurant.
Yeah.
So I love Mexico, actually, you know. That's, I suppose, you just got to make an art form of turning negatives into positives.
Yeah.
That's life.
What's your family situation now? Because you've got an older daughter, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got a daughter, Tamarin, who will be here in Hawaii on the 15th. She gets here a couple of days' time. She gets here. And then I've got a six-year-old son, Lion, who's inside here, going nuts because he can't see his friends and he can't, you know, he's back home, back where he feels like home. You know, he spent more time here than anywhere else in the world. And he can't even go out to go see him. He can't play with him. He's stuck inside with his parents. Go, this is crazy stuff.
It's a bummer he can't wear a hazmat suit and go around like John Travolta and the Boy in the Bubble.
I saw him out there at the airports, mate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's some, you know, there's some sincere fear out there. You know, and it makes me question myself because I always go to the, you know, just naturally to the conspiracy side of things. And it's what my mind most easily understands. And this, I have to kind of, the whole thing has to, you have to keep yourself in check and your own, ask yourself a few questions about your consistency of the place you go to in assessing the situation.
But you've always been a suspicious of authority.
Yeah, and I to say the least, I have, that's right. And I always had a sense of, I don't know, it's, you know, I don't want to get too deep in things. And, you know, it's one of the things that doing the blast off video challenge and being around so many kids and around the grommets and that energy, right? And it's all about the coaching and all of this good vibes. Then you come out and turn the telly on and go, oh no, I forgot. Chaotic out there. People are losing their businesses. People, mums and dads who have worked their life to create some independence, create their form of freedom. Their opportunity to feed their family and create a life for themselves being taken over this situation. And I understand people are dying and people die. And that's what, but you know, it's one of those realities of life, is that that's the only thing I know for sure. So I feel like there's, you know, I feel sorry for people who are in that situation, who are having to, and people who are sick and all of that stuff too, of course. But for those people whose lives are being changed permanently outside of their control. So surely, right, for a period of lockdown, anything of a financial consequence should be null and void. Right? There should be no responsibility of anyone to pay anyone for anything in the periods of lockdown. And all of our financial responsibilities should be over, should be just let go. Instead of giving us money that creates debt that enslaves us to the rest of our future, perhaps we just forget about all the money. And no one owes anyone anything for a little period of time until you say we can come out, if that's the way it is. You know, I can't buy people losing their lives and being told to and forced to in some forms in like a police state fashion. That's a hard thing for this whole freedom seeker to deal with, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And a lot of people are unaware that they're actually going to die one day. And that's the underlying thing. It's a lot of people don't actually accept the fact that we are mortal. I mean, no one lives forever.
And the features and the characteristics of similarity between the human and the animal are a little too obvious for me to ignore, you know?
In what way?
Well, I just see myself of animal evolution. I see myself as a cog in the line of forever, you know, in terms of, it's a long time, mate, and things have been around for billions of years, billions and billions of years, and I just see myself as a part of that evolution, and that's my anchor to my perception of the rest of the world around me. Yeah? Is that way I look at myself? I don't see myself as better than. I don't see myself as special. I just see myself as just another little living organism on the face of the planet that one day won't be. You know, it's such an opportunity. It's such a fantastic opportunity. Life itself, mate. You know, I look at it like that and just go, wow. Wow, a moment in time where things are that good that we get a run, you know?
It's so good to have a fucking run on the paddock, isn't it?
It's so good to have a run, mate. And I'm essentially not scared. And I spend my life trying to confront those things that scare me. And if they scare me, I do them. And that's what I do. If I'm scared of something, I look out there and I see it and I go, and I go do it. And it's all managed risk, obviously. And you try to manage your exposure to the risks and the things that may scare you or may threaten you or may put your life at risk, or, you know, that whole spectrum of what real fear is and what real fear ain't. It's a wide stroke of the brush. But I think, you know, I said, you've got to confront your fear. That's growth. That's living. So I, you know. Funny times.
what are some of your fears? What are some of your most recent fears?
I'm scared of everything, mate. You know what I mean? I'm full of fear, really. And I'm not scared of being scared. When you're living in that innocence that we talked about as that Whale Beach period in my life as a child, and then in a movie, and the thing just goes boom, and the scenes change, and life is different. You know what I mean? As that happens, that's what I lived. And when you realize the fragility of life and of this opportunity, you don't take for granted. You know, I've never been bored a day in my life. I don't know boredom. I don't even understand what it is. I wouldn't mind a bit of boredom. I don't know what to do with myself. I've got lists of stuff I've got to do where I'm always behind. Always. And I'm always like that, chasing the ball, because I've got stuff I want to do. In this little go around the block.
And it's so brief. The time we have here is so brief. So whenever I see people bored or they're sad and all sorts of things, like, fuck, you don't have long. Enjoy, because it's going to be over in a sec.
Yeah, and we grew up in a society that was what it was by design, not by fault or luck or chance. You know what I mean? The powers that owned our existences since the day the land was stolen, right, of all of it, because when you think in a global sense, at some point, no one owned the land and every bit of land was stolen. And as we've civilized as a society, stuff has kind of got dispersed out from royal families that kind of ran and owned, and it's been let out bit by bit to the people. And standards of living have been coming up, and the middle class has been given a chance to create, and people have a life. And that's a beautiful thing. That's, we've been on this road to sharing and to kind of a more even, fairer playing field from a, might I say, not from a very, you can't be proud of our history. There's stuff to be proud of, right? And there's obvious human giving and sacrifice and all of these wars and fights for freedom along the way, but back in it, the tyranny and the slavery and the racism, the sexism, and all the things that people are coming out against now is real, and our history is not something you can look at here. Real wonderful beings. the human species. Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, and it is the human condition. I mean, in every society, in every civilization, you know, there is, you know, racism and caste systems and
And we're not very, talk about a short time, we're not very far from being back when that was. And when I was a kid, call it the 60s, I remember what it was like. I remember the racism that Mi'kmaq would encounter when we walk along the street. I never even looked at the ways, I never look at people differently. I don't have a sense of myself better than anyone or different to anyone. We're all the same. Doesn't matter what you look like, how you, I mean, that's back to that animalistic interpretation of self, where there's this opportunity to
kind of, the fear of difference.
Yeah. And you know, that's what I hope out of all this whole thing is that, you know, people, there's talk of awakenings and there's the spotlight being turned on certain areas of our lives that seem like they needed the spotlight turned on them. And, you know, let's just hope things can change and we can become a fairer, more inclusive, loving, stoked society, recognising this fantastic opportunity.
Do you see it as an awakening, though, or merely as a power struggle? I see more power struggle than awakenings.
Well, the problem for me is that at times I don't have that much faith. You know, at times I go, oh, the humans. We're, you know, it's like, and that's what's been great. That's the great thing about travel, isn't it? Is different cultures have different things and give you differently and share with you differently. And you know what I mean? And you go, oh, that little part of the world that I grew up in for that bit of time that wasn't so nice and wasn't so caring and wasn't so giving and it's pretty gnarly. That was just a moment in time. Look over here, you know. So there's. I just feel like there's this wonderful opportunity to just be open about everyone and everything and realize that we're all the same and that's real and we're all made of the same stuff. And the word in the street might be that we're more virus and bacteria than we are human cells. So being comfortable with the exposure to viruses and that preeminent thing that's in our lives and makes the species grow stronger through the experience and people do lose their lives and that's, you know, never nice. But there's nature at play too. You know what I mean? And there's the humans, the human playing God role that can get you into trouble and can end up polluting your planet. So you look around and go, oh, what the hell happened? Oh, we never cared about it. We thought it just regenerated. We never even actually thought about it. We just threw it all out there. You know, that's kind of where we're at, isn't it? And there's this, you know, you go, when you see the pollution that's out there and now you get on a plane and you see the use of single-use plastics coming back into fashion because of a virus.
Oh, the fucking plastic thing? And you get on a plane and you ask for a drink of water and they give you a fucking bottle. Yeah, mate, just... Mate.
Could I feel that? I've got one of these. Could I feel that? They go, no, sorry, can't. They go, well, we don't touch it. But, you know. So there's a lot of things happening out there for the environment as a byproduct of the fear that is in existing in parts of the world and community that can't forget the poor environment. We can't just forget that, you know, the single-use plastic thing has got to stop. You can't. It's just... It's radical out there. There's a lot of plastic and a lot of rubbish and we ain't going to be the ones that have to deal with it. And that's what I love about Blast Off, mate. I love the kids and I love giving and it's because they are the future. We might not have done such a great job of looking after things. And they may come in as custodians and look at it and go, wow, we won't be doing what they did. Let's fix this up. And that's what's going to happen. And we've got it. The sooner that we as adults can assume responsibility and, you know, the living in an economy. I thought it was a community. I thought it was a society. I said, when did it become an economy? Oh, it's an economy. I forgot that's more important than the other bits. You know what I mean? So there's that balance in there that's got to be found to where businesses are responsible for what they're putting out there. That's the bottom line. They're putting so much crap into our environment and making money off it and profiting off it without being responsible for the end product. And that loop's got to be closed.
And but the great thing in a capitalist society is the consumer can stop that loop. If we all stopped using plastics, no one would make plastics.
Very hard, eh?
Yeah, it's very fucking hard. I can't buy strawberries because it's always in a plastic punnet or a pair of blueberries.
My wife will go to Whole Foods and come back and everything's in. I thought it was meant to be healthy. What's everything in the plastic bowl? Because we've got, and now more than ever before. Before you could have picked up your cherries and put your things in, and you know, whatever. And but now it's like, it's got to be in plastic because it might get germs on it. Like, so there's this whole, yeah, where the balancing things, I don't know, to me, now more than ever, you've got to listen to yourself. And you've got to not, you know, there's that whole going out for information. And the sources I see out there, I wouldn't be going to for information. They don't seem that reputable, and they seem like they, and it's been one of my niggles with media for a very long time, is that they're servants of the advertiser, and the advertiser creates, they're only there if they're comfortable with what you do, and if what you do doesn't make them comfy, then you're going to have to tinker, and there's that compromise of integrity that comes with the very nature of the thing when it's an advertiser, or even if it's not, it's in the hand of the government, then it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a really, you know, well, how do you find the truth?
I've been struggling
to find the truth. I'll hear things like the CDC, and I'll see a meme or whatever, you know, that says that they've re-evaluated their numbers by 94%. That's a small little error, 94. And there were people that died of it, not of it. So 6%, the actual number. And then you go try and find that. I've been on the CDC website, and I've seen their best case scenario and what they figure the chances are in terms of numbers on their website. And when you look at those numbers there on the website, and please, I hope people don't, you know how people get, hey, I'm not doing this because I've got an agenda. I'm not doing this because it's what I think and I care and I'm going to fight and argue about it with people. I don't. You know what I mean? You know me.
Yeah.
You know, I've been trying to shut my mouth for a very long time. You've caught it for a good time, because it's, you know, when you look at everything that's going on, it's one of them times in life, isn't it? It's extraordinary. And the emotion and all of the stuff that's out there, just try to breathe and try and stay calm and, you know, hope that people can see the good in each other and not see the bad in each other because you're a part of something that the other side, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, hopefully, I hope Trump loses the election in November, not because I have any axe to grind with the Republicans, just purely because it may mean the discourse might become a little bit more sensible.
Yeah, I don't see that happening either way, but I'm not, you know. That's, and again, we're in a place where we don't vote, don't have that right, and I just watch it and try and not have an opinion, you know what I mean? Because the minute I've got an opinion, I'm going to see what I need to see to validate my opinion. That's the human condition.
Yeah, you're looking for the echo.
So the minute you take a stand and say this is this, and all of a sudden you're looking for those things to validate this is this, and then people are coming at you with the attack from the other side because you've stood one way or the other. And I just hope people can grow beyond those attacks and let people have an opinion. Let them care. Everyone's different. We all think differently. We have different gods, different religions, different upbringings, different everything. And I just, it's all okay, you know. And there are certain things you've got to draw the line on. But with most of what's thrown around, when people are taking a side, we can get over that. You know, if we can't, then what's the hope of government or the bigger picture doing it?
Yeah, true.
The manifestations of us.
Yeah. Hey, 5 years ago, the wonderful Matt Warshaw, you know Matt, wrote that you were his number one pick for a commentator, that we should crowdfund to get you on the tour, and he asked you for a comment about sort of commentary during events, and you sent him this message. It's beautiful. I'm just going to read it. He said, "I never get involved in these type of discussions, but can't help myself. My feeling is that the product needs definition. Is it a sport or a free surfing exhibition? The fact that it is a sport, as it's designed and defined by the rules, but the commentary makes it seem as if we're just watching free surfing, not a contest. I've never watched a heat and felt as if it's been properly explained how and why someone lost or won. Occasionally, a surfer will come in and tell you he lost the heat because he misused priority or did something wrong, and you might get some insight into what actually went down. Kelly is great at this. Most commentators don't like the fact that every heat is actually won by wave selection, the use of priority, and the management of time by strategy. commentators almost deny the existence of strategy and try and make us believe heats are won by just surfing. You know, it's an interesting take on commentary, you know. And then you said that my experience is that heats are less often won by surfing, more often won by strategy, and that's what makes it interesting. So we already know that surfing. It's the rest of that needs to be illuminated. So you are a popular commentator, you know. What do you try and do when you're when you got the mic?
I try to remember it's not about me. That's my primary goal, mate. That's my primary focus, because Lord knows, you know, the ego is strong. But I can be a wanker. And sometimes you just got to keep, I should always go, remember, it's not about you. It's not about you making your point. It's not about you being right or wrong. It's about me seeing what I, because I don't, I say this quite funny, I don't know much. You know what I mean? When it comes to this, there's a whole sort of near on 10-year, 8-year period that I didn't watch a single heat. I never saw Andy Irons surf a heat against Kelly Slater. I never saw any of that whole thing go down. So, hey?
Why didn't you watch it?
Oh, when I retired from the tour, I didn't really like it very much. None of us did. Think back to when we did it, mate. It wasn't a very loving organism. It was an infrastructure of business. Perhaps to sell more T-shirts than it was to create futures for professional surfers. And the environment was hostile, and it treated us like product, mate. We were in and out. And if you weren't in, you were out, mate. And if you said things that they didn't like, you weren't getting anywhere in that thing. And there were some people that stuck their necks out more than others. And when I retired, the last thing in the world I wanted to do was go near a contest or near the ASP. Please, you're killing me. I was drowning in there. I was dying in there. And like, you get out and it's like, oh, nice growing up. I thought I knew that. You didn't know that, you know.
But you did 15 years and, you know, you won a world title in 88, runner-up 85, third in 87, won the QS in 93. Don't you remember that?
Yeah. That was one of the things I was most proud of, I've got to say.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. I was 30 years old and I was on the back end of my career. My daughter had just been born. Tamron was born in 93 and she was coming and I was scared, mate. I needed money. I needed to win. I'd had some bad business experiences the first go around and, you know, after the world title thing and then into the 90s. I wasn't really liking it. I wasn't enjoying it on there too much. You know what I mean? I was politically active and engaged to the point where it was ruining the experience of being a surfer. You know? And so why I did that to myself, I don't know. I always go, and that's why I try to say what I say today with utmost respect. And so people feel you and know that you don't. I'm happy for them to be different. Think whatever you want. But so... That was a bit of a loop from about commentating. But yeah, I try to make sure it's not about me.
But you know, but back to your career, you won 17 contests and you were the first to admit you weren't a Potts or a Curran or an Oki, but you did everything you could to minimize luck. That you did a lot of theory. Mm. What did you do? How did you win?
Yeah. You know how it is. You don't know yourself. When you are you know what I mean, and you're younger or whatever, you don't really know yourself, and you don't have confidence. And if you think about it, you know, I would say confidence is literally a choice. It's nothing more than a choice. You can manufacture it through your efforts, which are based on your judgments of what you need to do to achieve that confidence, to achieve the goal. I've seen absolute rare individuals of life just choose confidence and just have it, mate. They don't, you know what I mean? They don't. And it's understanding that's the case, and then, you know, choosing it, not being fragile about it, you know? And it's not that you're not. I'm confident in myself, mate. You know what I mean? I believe I know myself. I know what I think. And I know, I kind of feel like I know, but when I was a kid on that tour, I didn't know myself very well. I was scared, mate. No one ever told me I would succeed. No one ever said to me, oh, you'll do it, mate. You know, if I'd like a, you know, laugh at you, go, hey, I'll show you. If that's, you know, and then down there enough people do that, you just go, let's go, mate. any day, any time, anything. Martin, who? Tom, who? I don't care. Let's go. I'm taking you out. I was hungry, mate. No, I didn't have a backup plan. I left school to be a professional surfer. I told him at Career Guidance, so I'm going to be a world champion surfer. I go, mate, you ain't the smartest tool in the shed. Maybe you should get a some kind of trade behind you. I remember you'd be a boiler maker, cabinet maker. I'm going to go, you're not hearing me. I'm going to be a world champion surfer. I'm right. Don't worry about me. Worry about another kids, mate. That's what I used to kind of be like. I knew what I was doing. And, I mean, those Mossman years is a, I don't know what you call it, like as another chapter. they are fascinating, mate. I learned a lot of stuff and did some stuff I'm not necessarily proud of, but I was creative, I was inventive, and I financed my life from 11 years old. And I've owned my existence and held my freedoms and never been a burden to my mum, never, you know what I mean, caused her grief or made her have to do anything or anything. And that was something. That's kind of, it's who you are. That's how you win. Long story short. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter whether you paddle this one, you paddle that one. Becoming a pro surfer is a personal development course for those of the most fragile nature. You know what I mean? Because we're in there. There's not many people who grow up and are willing to go and lose every day of their life to prove a point. And it weeds them out. People, you know, we go there and we lose all. That's what we do, mate. And if you go there and win, no one expects it anyway. The guy is a good competitor. Shit surfer, but good competitor. You know what I mean? Yeah, thanks, guys. Love it. Such a nice community. so there's those things you go through to be you. And I think I went through. I had some lessons early in life that I've been managing my situations in a conscious fashion for a very long time.
What were some of those early lessons, you know, apart from the death of your father?
Don't take it for granted. You know what I mean? You got to be present and you got to be living. And I look at life as a body of work. When we're gone, it's a body of work that's left behind you. And that's your contribution to your family, to your culture, your sport, to your world. You know what I mean? That's what you give is that body of work. And I'm conscious about my body of work. When I was a pro surfer, I used to do interviews and say things and behave in ways and just to get a reaction, just to piss them off, just to, you know what I mean? It's naughty. It's like, and you know, now I'm way more conscious about other people's feelings. I'm way more conscious about other people's cultures and their, and the way they do things, you know. We used to come to countries and just rock in like we owned the joint, this just marauding bunch of Viking Australians or something. Or this, you know, and then as it grew, it was great times, but I feel like I might have been disrespectful quite a lot, mate. You know what I mean? As I reflect and I kind of go, oh, jeez, there's one of them things, you know. You asked me what I'd learned. You know, I learned I've kind of got an anger problem. I get angry, mate, and the thing snaps and I punch stuff. Like, you know what I mean? I go, you still learn. I thought I was over it, but I'm not over it. And as I kind of reflect on my life, I look at situations now with that awareness around my own emotional responses to situations. That could have been one. Oh, Greg Clough dumping you. That could have been one. Oh, that one with that guy when he kneed you in the nuts and dropped you that night at the board riders preso. That could have been one. You know what I mean? All of a sudden you were thinking all these other people are the bad guys and you were just getting way of what, you know. But the realities are that you put yourself where you are and you create your opportunities. And it's that, I love that. You know what I mean? I love that opportunity to do some stuff and make some stuff happen. And I look at the young pros of today, and I'm sure all my mates and brothers from my generation look at it the same and go, oh, if only we knew what we knew now. You know, you would just, you know, imagine the opportunity for us guys to come together and to have made something of that moment. Call it the 80s with these amazing characters. It's like a circus with this wonderful cast that's being dominated by a ringleader who doesn't have a clue, but he's looking at balance sheets. You know what I mean? And, and to me, that's why I was on that board for 10 years. That's why I wanted to do stuff. I was like, let's take this over. Let's run this way. Let's do that. You know, we conducted the coup, which was the creation of the coup was the creation of the Dream Tour. And I know other people talk about the creation of that would be, you know, the Dream Tour, but the Dream Tour was started by the coup where we sacked Graham Cassidy and Peter Burness at the meeting. And you know, I look at Graham Cassidy now in retrospect, and what an incredible man he was. You know what I mean? He was outside of that clique that then took over in his absence, because we went in and took those guys out because we wanted to go to good waves. We had the best surfers in the world, were riding the worst waves in the world, and the sport was dying.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really any real movements to change it. So we had the votes. I lobbied on the other side, got the votes, went to the meeting, no one saw it coming. We replaced management and the Dream Tour was started. That was it. You know, so I feel like the kids today have got that entrepreneurial spirit. You see it in edits, you see it in the creation of brands and events, and I really like, that's why I look at the shape of the surfing part of things, you know, outside of everything else, and it's so good. So good. Connests are sick. Like, I think not having them makes you realize they're pretty sick. I do, I like having those. I have trouble watching ones that don't mean anything.
Like the recent events at Stratty and Cavill?
No, just ones that I know that don't, because maybe that was just my attitude coming through in me and feeling like I just know that you're different every time you compete. And when there's big stuff on the line, it's all in. And you go in there, it's kind of like a holiday kind of.
Yeah. When you were talking just before, it reminded me of about the 80s when you got beat up by Marines in Japan. Was it Japan? Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. Well, anger. There you go, mate. So I never really confronted my death, my father's death. When we moved the town, you know, I just knuckled up, mate. I just kind of went, let's go. We've got stuff to do here. No one's looking out anymore. And it was a real, you know, like I said, the Mossman days and the creativity and the way I managed situations there to fund and prosper my future was quite, you know, it's a story for another day. But I remember being here in Hawaii at Turtle Bay and having an argument. I must have been 18, having an argument with Nick Carroll, him telling me that I must hate. And me going, hey, I don't know hate. I literally don't hate. I don't know hate. I don't even know what you're talking about emotionally. And I was serious. Lord, life teaches you some lessons. but I remember arguing about that I hadn't experienced hate. So even with my father's death, I'm pretty, I don't know, understanding of life and the way it works, you know. But that night in Japan, it had been a few nights where, you know, first night 15 of us went in on the train all together, great times. Second night there's 8 of us. Third night there's a couple. And Rod Kerr and I stayed and because we had met some friends, and that gentleman came up and started carrying on like an, you know,
pork chop.
Yeah, pork chop, exactly. Well done. And he said he was a US Marine, and his words were, and they rang in my ear, that he would kill his mother and father if they were in the line of duty and he was ordered to. And at the time, I was so angry, mate. I just couldn't believe what I'd heard. And I was like, mate, you need some help with that. Yeah. And I then looked at Box. I can't help it. I've got to clock him. I've never punched anyone in my life, mate. I'm not a fighter, you know what I mean? But the anger was there, mate. In the moment was, you know, I just went, rah, and just clocked him in the head. And then it was kind of The next thing you know, he's mates of. Next thing you know, it's just whatever, and I got knocked unconscious essentially.
Do you remember much about the fight? Like, so you threw the punch, and then did he take it? And then
He took it. He went. He kind of took it and stepped back, and then said, "You're gone." And started walking off to get his mates. And I went, Box and I looked at each other. We're out of here, but quick, into the toilets. And we're in a basement. And the toilet had no window, straight out of the toilet. Quick, no, out there. Straight into them. And I literally got held and beaten unconscious. Lickings, bro. Lickings, because Lord knows. So that, that was, again, I look at these experiences in my life and you're always growing and you're never there. You're never perfect. That's the surfing metaphor for life is just the most wonderful metaphor of all. You take your lessons out of the ocean and apply them onto land and try and live with that. And you're a chance of not being a wanker.
Slight chance.
Hey?
Very slight chance.
Slight chance, yeah. So, yeah.
Hey, talk to me about, I think this is pretty good, your rivalry with Potts. I mean, I remember years ago, I interviewed him for a Surface Journal story. It was a big story. I spoke to everyone from Mark Price to Mike Cruikshank and everyone. And Potts was in the car and had a whole bunch of surfer magazines that coincidentally that somebody given me had, from the 80s. And he's flipping through and he flips to a double page instant advertisement of you at Pipe, during that remarkable final day in 88.
I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah, and the 20-point caption just read, Barton Lynch, world champ, 1989. And Potts was just fucking livid. He goes, what the fuck is this? I was the 89 world champion. And this is, 20 years after the fact.
Typo.
Yeah, it was a typo, yeah, because it's obviously 88 world champion. But for this story, I interviewed you, and you said you beat him in a couple of pivotal heats early in his career, once at Narrabeen and once at Lackanau. And from that point in time, it was well and truly fucking on.
Mm. Yeah, he did. At the time, he didn't like getting beaten by me, and he didn't think he most probably didn't think he could be. You know what I mean? He had that, And it was doubles back to, I was a wild card in the event at Narrabeen in that one. Little knee-high lefts, 100 whacks, Super fun. And then France, and the semis in France, and I suppose I never wouldn't have gone into a heat with Potts going, I know I'm going to beat him. There were people.
He was a superhero.
No, and he's incredible. Like, he's incredible, mate. He was so fast. And his story's an absolute ripper too, mate. I suppose your mateship that you carry after it is just the best ever, And so what fueled, and Tom Carroll too, right? And what fueled the rivalry between me and them was Peter Manstead. Remember Peter Manstead?
Yeah, the mad old manager who calls you up when you're in Newcastle.
He was managing them. And he was managing me, but I saw it early. And I got out of there, Potts and Tom, I wish you told us earlier. You were too deep, mate. You wouldn't have heard me. So that was one of those ones where he fueled that rage between them and I, and he would tell them lies of things that I said or did or wrote. Tom says to me now that he's, yeah, you said I did steroids. And I go, mate, I don't think I ever said that. I don't remember ever saying that. I remember other people saying it. And it being around, but I never, because he's trying to tell me I said it, and I'm going, I think Peter Manstead might have, And so he was in there driving that division between me and them, because the last thing he wanted me to do was succeed, because I'd walked away from him and told him to stick it, because I didn't like his way. And they stayed with it, and it was them against me, and then Duma joined in with me, and it was Duma and me against, It was like there was some strong emotions and some big characters and some, that's our generation, had some massive characters, and no one was going to take a backward step. No one was going to surrender that moment or that opportunity through nicety. There wasn't enough to go around. There's only some people eating. The rest of us were piecing it together, So it was very young, and I'm so excited to have been a part of pro surfing in those days.
Because there's like, there's a great story where Manstead was ringing up in your hotel room in Newcastle and threatening you, and you hung up, called your new manager Dirk Cook, and said, "Mate, Manstead's hassling me." And Dirk just goes, "Well, fuck this, I'm just going to drive up." And he came up and dropped him.
Yeah, yeah. He was ringing me, telling me that people were coming to my room. Come down to the foyer. I'm here. I go down to the foyer. There's no one there. There were knocks on my door. Open it. No one there. I was getting terrorized by the lunatic. And so it just, I was edgy, obviously. I wasn't feeling good about it. And my manager rang and he could tell that he was like, "Well," I said, "Oh, that rubberneck's just giving me, it's just working me, mate." And he just jumped in the car, drove up. I was commentating with Mark Richards on NBN, and they come into the commentary booth and tap me on the shoulder and go, "You've got to come. Something really bad's happened. You've got to come." And I was like, "Oh shit, my mum's dead too." That was the first thing I thought. My mum's dead too. Oh, well, here we go. It's true. And they go, I walk in there and they're there and they go, "Oh, your manager just punched out Peter Manstead." And I was like, "And?" The problem is, you know what I mean? $5,000 each, we got fined, me and Potts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a bit of a hit back in.
That's like a hit back then, mate. But, you know, it was. I'm not condoning the situation, but it was just. Those were the days, mate. It was a different environment, a different world. And, you know, there was literally not one parent around. Not a single parent, and a bunch of kids running around the world.
Yeah.
It's really a wonderful. You were there in parts, you remember what it was like. And then, you know, to go to war against people, like we all did, and then get that chance, and that's where the pots of my story, you know, we get that chance to, I moved back to where I grew up, which is Whale Beach, which in 93, and Potts is like the king there.
Yeah.
And I'm like Simba, and I've come home. and so we just, you know, in the end, we just surfing together every day, drop the kids at school, meet, go surf, hang out all day, pick the kids up after school, hang out all night and hang kids play and make dinner for the kids. And those we spent, you know, and heaps of times. And they were our kind of darkest in terms of financial opportunity, in terms of a future. We didn't know our future. We didn't have one.
Because you had both had the young kids, you both had retired, Potts had pissed all his money up against the wall. You probably never had any money. And then I remember you telling me you guys became kind of soulmates over that.
Yeah, we both blew our opportunities and trusted the wrong people, and we're just young kids, mate. We had no idea the world we're stepping into. And he was 2 years younger than me, and he is, you know, he has the constitution of an absolute ox, mate. Potts is he's a very, very strong individual who can handle enormous amounts of stress, enormous amounts of pressure, enormous amounts of, I don't know, like having to find yourself in the midst of other people's situations. And, you know, he's a strong piece of work. And we got to know each other and spend all that time together and share our stories and share our past, because we didn't really know each other. We used to hate each other, you know. And then we got to, you know, and we worked together on projects, and, you know, it was really cool. And we, you know, we became brothers in that sense. And Tom Carroll's the same. Tom and I, you know, we talk a lot, and we, you know, they're my besties, mate. The guys you're at war with are your best mates. They understand you. They know what we went through. They know what you went through, and they know who you are on the other side of that as a friend or as a brother in a in a life relationship. And I think all of us feel like that's the thing we got out of that time on tour. The money was, you know, enough to buy yourself a house or two, most probably, if you didn't blow it. Yeah. And set that kind of a foundation up for your life. It wasn't like today where there weren't people walking around wanting to create companies with you or wanting to, you know, create commercial opportunities with you. We didn't know Hollywood stars. You know, that came with the momentum generation, that kind of popularity and notoriety of surfing came with those guys, you know. ours is a different thing to that, so.
You told me something really, really cool when I interviewed you for the Pot story. You said, "I've always felt a bit alone in this world. I'm not a part of a clique or company or a group. There's no one really batting for my team. And in a lot of ways, Potts feels like that too. I remember one afternoon and we were having some beers and reflecting on life, and he goes, who do I trust? Who do I turn to? Who do I have to share anything with? All I've got is myself. And I said, well, you've got me too.
Yeah, bruh. Yeah, that's, you know, that's the spirit of what we live through. You know, I think that we're all, you know, we were in the trenches, and it was an experimental time. People didn't know right from wrong, good from bad, what was working, what wouldn't work. They were building a sport that was foundational. It's the sickest stuff ever to me.
Yeah.
You know, I love the story of Rabbit walking to school dreaming of a tour.
Yeah.
You know, and those guys almost manifesting that tour into being out of their collective energy and desire to not work. That's me, mate.
When you're on the tour, there was Shane and there was Rabbit, and then you went through all those guys, and then you went through even the Kelly generation.
And yeah.
He was tired at, you know, 30 or something. I think Potts was 28. But Kelly is still there. After, you know, almost 30 years after winning a world title, he's still there.
Yeah. How good's that autopilot?
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable, mate. It's so well rehearsed, and it's so ingrained. It's so deep, so structural that he almost doesn't need to be there. You know what I mean? Like he being there almost gets in a way in its way, because it's such a rude pattern of behavior. I can't, you know, I'm constantly astonished by that part, you know, the surfing, and then looking at where it is, the kids are that good. How's the airs coming out of Waco and stuff? Like
that point has been the biggest thing, I think, to performance surfing. Maybe possibly in history.
Yeah, well, and I suppose, you know, I look at jet skis as well. Mm-hmm. And go, jet skis, massive, mate. People wouldn't be paddling them ways. You couldn't be out there. They'd still think you couldn't be out there until you were out there on a ski and went, oh, maybe you could, you know. Yeah. Jet skis were massive. And so, the thing I'm stoked most about is that I'm just on the verge of being young enough to keep learning these things.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember the first off the back of the tour, and I came here to the house, and TB1, the original snowboard trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
TB1, because Mike Hatchett had stayed here because he was friends with Aaron Chang. The VCR was in the thing, and I get to the house and I'm like, what's this? I put it in and I see snowboarding for the first time. And I'm like, holy, by the end of it, I'm on the ground, I'm stretching, I'm going, I'm doing that? What is that? Whoa. And I was just tripping on how good snowboarding looked, you know. And then I remember I was at home, I was injured, I was out of the water, and I saw some footage of Jaws came on, toe surfing Jaws on the news.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm kind of, it's in that period where I'm disconnected completely from surfing.
Yeah.
You know, I did 8 years, I didn't look at a magazine, go to an event. I knew nothing, saw nothing, happily. Fantastic times. No, I'm joking.
You must have seen Derek and Laird, though, at the front of Backyards, though.
Yeah, well, I remember seeing a vapor trail the first day, right? I remember the first day I saw it out front, seeing the vapor trail coming down and going, oh, my God, there's someone on that. And then watching and seeing it come through and going, before that news story had ended, I was stretching again. You know what I mean? I'm on the ground, I'm stretching, and I just – and then I saw foiling. I was like, God, we've got to learn that. We absolutely have to learn that. You know, and I committed 6 weeks straight. I was here and I only foiled for 6 weeks straight besides 3 days towing in 6 weeks. Every other surf was a foil surf to learn it, you know, and if I'm going to get it, we got to go. And so the fact that those things bring such a thrill to my life, I get that excited, eh? And I just have that much fun. Just being out in the ocean, blatting around, just riding waves, and that's when you get off the tour, it actually comes back to you. You're like, I knew I loved it. You know, I knew I enjoyed it. And you kind of get your spirit back. But, you know, 15 on that tour then, with the way it was and the people the way they were and the, you know, there's all sorts of abuse coming your way from all sorts of directions. You know, that wasn't light. You couldn't be lighthearted in that environment, eh?
It's interesting that, you know, you've created you know, be all blast off. Because amongst all the kids that I know, it's bigger than WSL. It's one thing that, you know, matters when it comes on, the week is in the school holidays and every kid goes to Whaley or whatever and they go do and they talk about it. No one talks about, you know, Hossagora, no one talks about, you know, maybe Pipe a little bit. But the great thing about the event, I think, was all kids are really welcome to it, even if you're a bit of a kook. Yeah. You surf a couple of times. Yeah, you know, you weren't getting 0.3 of your waves. You just go, oh, yeah, you finished six. But, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, I know that's, you know, I have strong opinions and I think I know, I knew back then when I was looking at events that for kids, I knew they were wrong. 3.79, 2.83, 7.54, 9.35. So that's all you hear for 20 minutes, right, is them reading out numbers. And then there's this two-wave total of 7.38 and it came six and there's this bombardment of numbers. The parents will stand around going, what do we tell them? What do you do wrong? What do you do right? And they're trying to understand the math to try and turn it into, I was like, it's just not how you do it, mate. You don't score rides, you coach them. And you tell them what they're doing right and wrong. And you get great people who are respected. And I want to, after this, I've got to share, this is a segue into something I wanted to share with you and get your opinion on.
Yeah.
And because I've had strong opinions about the judging, right? And it's not a personal thing in any way. And I love all that. I'm friends with all those blokes, you know what I mean? And it's nothing to do with them personally. But what are your chances of getting five people to agree?
It's very small.
Yeah, that's what they say, right?
Yeah.
Try and get five people to agree on anything.
Yeah.
Your system is kind of the confidence in the system is around uniformity to the scores. So as your natural instinct, I think in my mind back then, be going, I think they're going 7-5. You know, and you go, yeah, we got it. Yeah, we look good. If you're way up or way down or not keeping that thing uniform so the presentation of the interpretation is clean of controversy, and so you get to this point where it's a very difficult system. It doesn't matter who you got working in that system. It's a tough system to work in, and they do a great job given that they're set up to fail by the nature of the system, in my humble opinion. And so back to the old days, 5-0, 4-1, 3-2. You could call it an 8, I could call it a 4. We could have different best waves. We could have completely different looking sheets for a reason of our own interpretation of the performances, which is what you want. You want to encourage the interpretation of an expert, right? And when I say expert, I ain't good enough to judge. Right, flat out. No, and I don't.
Listen to the pool if you're not expert enough to judge.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm not good enough to judge, mate. No, you need people that know, mate. And to me, I think you most probably only need three of them, right? And it should be the best people your money can buy. And if I'm going to Pipeline, my panel is going to be CJ Hobgood, Shane Dorian, and Joel Parkinson,
yeah.
Right? And I want to turn, I believe this is the way it should be because the experts should pass on what is good surfing. It should be passed on by elders. And it should be elders that aren't too elderly but are current enough to interpret, me included. You know what I mean? So I feel like, and then they are, right, they're your entertainment. Your three judges, Ron Dog and I are there and we're going, look, and the score comes in and there's a difference from an 8 or a different interpretation of the best two rides. Whatever the interpretation is good because it's your entertainment. And you go to your judges and we go up to Shano now and just see why he went down on that four and why. So you go to Shane and Shane's like, yeah, you know, when he came off that bottom and he caught that little bit of an edge, I just, at that point, it lost me. I wasn't there with it. And then on the one behind it, and you get the explanation from the judge and you're bringing the best in the business in to illuminate what it is you're judging. And then you got, you know, you got three judges to one. 3-0 or 2-1. And I've said, let me fix judging. Promise you, I'll fix it. Let me fix it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like so much of what WSL done has been amazing for the sport. and the fact that we take leading roles in equal pay for women, the fact that the respect that WSL shows for the surfers is I can't believe it at times. I sit there and scratch my head and go, wow, really? You even care what they thought about that? You know what I mean? Where I don't care what we thought. We weren't even asked. You know what I mean? Yeah. So there's that opportunity there, you know, and to elevate that part of your entertainment and that part of your decision making. And I come off it from blast off because when I said I wasn't going to score rides, and like, you can't do that. I go, yeah, we're just going to watch them and tell them. That's what you do at the beach. You know what I mean? You watch people surf and you get a feeling for where it went, and you know. So I feel like there's possibilities to create a way of judging our sport that really would change the presentation of the sport. And instead of them being people that are poor buggers, mate, tough job, eh? And those scores come in, the controversy goes, and you know, you wouldn't wish it on your best mate. You know what I mean? It's like it's a tough gig, and those people they're heartful and they love surfing, and that's why they're there. But I feel like they're not a part of the broadcast. They're just there to get that decision done and then kind of get on with the entertainment. But I think bringing them into the entertainment, especially if they're articulate elders and leaders of the sport, would just be such a credible move in terms of, you know.
And they get introduced, you know, like at a UFC fight, they introduce the judges, or a boxing match, they'll introduce the judges, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a, you know. So I think there's all sorts of opportunities out there, mate. And that's, oh, dude, I've been trying to shut up, but I knew I was just going to lose it when I spoke to you, eh? You got me at the perfect time.
Quarantine.
Three weeks into forms of quarantine.
I already watched 12 episodes of Emily in Paris. Yeah. Hey, what advice do you give to kids at your blast off contest? Because kids would probably, you know.
All sorts. So every video that comes in of the 250 we've got, I coach.
Oh, really?
So in the chat. Yeah. So there's their page, like their videos there, and you go to, there's 20 on a page, and there's 13, 14 pages now, and you go there and the 10 are there, and you click on the video, brings it up, and then there's a little chat room feature just on the side. So I go into every single video that comes in, and I give them some coaching. I tell them what I see, what I like, what we think they could work on. And I've got another coach who works with me in there, a coach who worked with me, Akko, through 87 and 92, he worked with me, and so he and I have been working together, so I brought him in there, and Kaius King was in there the other day and commenting on the kids' videos and stuff, and I was talking to Thomas today, this morning, Carol, and I was like, can you go in there and just let them know, you know, we love them, let them know you're there, and drop, you know. And
it's a good incentive to get your entry in. So for people that don't know, that Blast Off is virtual this year on video, and what an incentive to have you know, Barton Lynch, Tom Carroll, Kaius King, comment on your little wax.
Yeah, and then we got at the end of it all. So we've been doing, you know, we do kids who bring the stoke and just kids who put smiles on our face. We give stuff away every day of the 6 weeks, right?
Yeah.
Every single day we give away. We're giving away, you know, 20, 30 packs to kids so far, And then we've got some big prizes that we haven't really talked too much about. There was something I was working towards that isn't going to happen in time, but there's a project I'm involved in that we'll be announcing in about 6 months, maybe 5-6 months time, that I think is could be super amazing. And we're trying to tie them together, but it didn't work. But we've got a boat trip to the Maldives. Oh, wow. So what I've done is I've got a panel of Jack Robbo, Eli Hanneman, Vahini Fierro, Mahina Maeda and Kaius King.
Yeah, good
panel. So that's our six-person panel.
Yeah,
and we're gonna do a show, and make the announcements in the show. Look through the finalists, make our decisions, throw them around between us, come to our decisions, and make a little show at the end of it out of that. But our experts' choice, which we will decide, got two spots to come on a boat, our coaching trip to the Maldives. on the boat charter, coaching trip to the Maldives. And then for the public vote, we were thinking for boy and girl of the public vote, get to go to the Surf Lakes facility in Yeppoon.
Oh, nice.
That's been one of the hard parts about not going home too, is seeing the footage and knowing that. And then seeing the winter that was had down there too. It's like...
Crazy, right?
Yeah, it looked great. It looked so good.
You still got your house in Avon?
No, we sold that about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, that was... If what has happened now happened back when I had two mortgages, I would have been in an awful... I would have had another... You know, you were talking about it, but having a heart attack, having had a heart attack, you know.
Did you have a heart attack?
Yeah, I had a heart attack 5.5 years ago on Australia Day.
What happened?
I was surfing in a lyre, one of those pieces of wood, with my daughter Tamarin, and at Palmy, and I just got this weird tingle down my arm. I was like, that's odd, pins and needly odd thing, and it went away. Didn't even think about it. And we went home, and that arm, I was sitting on the couch doing some work, and it came back. And then it started the whole arm, and then my chest a bit, and it was my circumflex artery, which comes around the side and down into here.
Yeah.
And so it only came across. I thought I'd pinched a nerve. I was on the ground rolling on balls, massaging away, not facing the reality. And then my wife was breastfeeding Lion. He was 6 months old, and it was kind of – I got to live my worst nightmare. That's why I didn't want to have him, because my dad died. I'm 50. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be around. I'm scared. Don't make me go through this. And then all of a sudden you're having a heart attack, and we jump in the car – I go in the bedroom, fall on the bed, and Holly looks at me and goes, oh, you don't look good. And I know. We jumped in the car, and I go from my kid's 6 months old losing it. So I'd go from, it's okay, mate. It's okay, little plays, little tickles. It's okay, you'll be right. It's okay, little mate. You'll be all right. You'll be all right, you know. And then it was quite and in the hospital, and you're having a heart attack. Hey?
What were you feeling? This incredible crushing pain?
No, it was just I got clammy, sweaty palms, and just felt like I was going to black out. I was going to pass out. The pain itself and stuff, you know, like the elephant on your chest or those things. It wasn't any of that I felt, you know. And then once a week, I've got low blood pressure now. Since that, I've never had high blood pressure, but now I've kind of had low blood pressure a bit. And so I'll get up and be like, whoa, 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 dizzy, hold on, I like this. Or I'll be sitting and I'll move. And when it comes into what is these two fingers, it's your, I can't even remember what my wife said it was, your whatever nerve, right? And my arm will go all pins and needly. I'll be like, what's that? And then it'll be in these two. I go, no, it's that nerve. Okay. All right. So, and so, you know, at different points, I have moments where I feel things because I'm a little bit sensitive about it, perhaps, and it's just radical, you know. So you asked me earlier, you know, what you're scared of. Where do you start? I'm not, you know, one thing I'm not scared of is dying, honestly, and I feel like one of the flaws in our upbringing is the way we are brought up to deal with death. It don't have to be terrible. Don't have to be the worst thing in the world. Don't have to be this absolute. You know, we could be brought up to where we understand the consequences and we're emotionally impacted by it, of course. But it can be a celebration. He got a chance. He got 20 years. Yes. Good job, mate. You know, whatever it is, there's a different way to look at everything. And given the time we're in, maybe it's not a bad time to start looking at things, thinking about it, because that's, you know, she's a good opportunity, mate. Life is wonderful, and we've got, for the people in the worst situations of all, they're the people, you know, create an even playing field or an even opportunity to exist, utilizing the resources of the planet that considers all and actually doesn't consider the business as the backbone of it. And looked at it and went, you know what? We want to do as little work as we possibly can for our community, for our society, for the structure of what we live. And we want as many days to ourselves as we want. And we think the 5-2 was just an evolved form of slavery, which is exactly what it was, what it is. Yeah. The workplace today is an evolved form of slavery. It's a stock exchange. Yeah. An advanced form of slavery, you know? So, yeah, don't get me started again. I just start myself, don't I? You don't even have to say anything. I just start burying myself.
Amazing. Hey, but before you surf, and you're a butterfly collector, and do you think hanging up the net for the surfboard was it etymology's great loss? And do you ever miss a warm summer morning, you know, scooping up the creatures?
Scooping up. You know what? Yeah, it's a funny one, eh? I had quite the collection, and we used to breed them in they'll make little bit garbage bins and fly screen and metal and make little and go get the little, what do you call those things? Cocoons? No, what are they? Chrysalis. And put them in the thing, and you know, it was I don't know where it came from, and I had quite the collection, pin boarded, you know, into the pin board. And they were beautiful. I don't know where they are. They're one of the things I never kept through the crazy journey of life. But I think I was surfing at the same time, and soccer, surfing, and butterflies, and then surfing won the deal.
I think we all wanted that. That you stay with surfing and stop killing butterflies.
Yeah. I mean, that's another one. The way animals were looked at when I grew up was a little more as a tool than as a living organism creature that may actually have something you need to consider or respect. You know what I mean?
Just kind of kill them all and industrially farm them.
And I'm so happy to see those. There have been some big changes. And like we said, we're not very far from a very, very primitive place in history that, if you remember, the short time since we have evolved to this wonderful standard quality of living in some places, we're pretty fresh from the cave, and some of the stuff we did and have done and to get to where we are, there's a lot of it, you know, there's a lot to be proud of and a lot that you need to not pretend didn't happen, like Australian history they taught us at school.
Yeah, it's extraordinary what we didn't get taught, huh?
What kind of people are you looking after? You know, where was your heart? You know what I mean? Where was your? It's one of those things. You know, and it's.
But also, you can't get too down on collective guilt. Otherwise, we'd still be down on the Japanese for World War II and the Germans.
Well, that's why we just need to, you know, just need to elevate that respect for each other, and for differences of opinions, and the collective diversity of mankind is the beauty of it. That's what we want. Don't go sterilizing us all into one government, one. You know what I mean? The loss of your currency into call it the euro or whatever, it's the first step in losing yourself to something bigger than you. And my political sort of persuasion's always been about going the other way, going back to fewer and fewer people and making responsibilities at ground zero for yourselves as a collective community of, you know, there's all sorts of what, that's one of the things that bothers me, is that I don't know that I've ever heard anyone discuss social architecture. I've never heard anyone. I feel like there should be enormous amounts of money and expertise and smart minds put to work on figuring the best way to utilize the resources for all of us to have a great freaking time. That's the opportunity. You don't want to work forever so you can put plastic and pollution and stuff to this. You know what I mean? There's better things to do with your life than work, and people need to engage with themselves and their outdoors and their environments and get in life and live, and the thing will just start bubbling, cooking along, you know?
Hey, you're amazing. Thanks, Martin.
Pleasure, mate. My pleasure.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.